If you feel like, the world is just entirely breaking down around us, from chronic autoimmune diseases surging to a collapsing environment to just the absolute death of institutional trust. Well, what if I told you it's not a dozen different fires?
Right, because it really isn't.
Exactly. What if nobody can explain why everything is breaking all at once simply because we've been using, well, completely the wrong language to describe the problem?
Yeah, that's the core of it. We've been misdiagnosing it.
So today we're going to look at the biological blueprint to prove that it is actually one single underlying condition.
And it's a condition we have completely misunderstood, mostly because we've been trained to view the world as like a machine made of isolated parts, right?
Yeah.
Rather than a living, interconnected system.
I mean, that shift in perspective is everything. And to figure out how to transition away from that broken worldview, we are taking a massive deep dive today into a profoundly paradigm-shifting manuscript by Dr. Bechara Saley.
Got published in April 2026.
Right. It's called The Architecture of Coherence: Reintegrating Biological, Relational, and Institutional Systems for Civilizational Viability.
Which is quite the title, but it perfectly captures the scope.
It really does. So our mission today is to take you on a journey, starting from the microscopic biological reality of our own cells, moving up through human psychology and relationships, and all the way to how we actually design our global economy.
And to ground this massive undertaking, there is a really striking visual metaphor that Dr. Saley introduces right at the beginning of the
Oh
text.
yeah, I loved this part. Paint that picture for us.
So imagine on the left side of the page, you have this sprawling network of just fragmented, disconnected grid lines.
Like a broken map.
Exactly. You see these stray dots, jagged angles, pathways that just, they dead end into absolutely nothing. It looks incredibly chaotic, almost like a shattered circuit board.
Right, it feels stressful just looking at it.
Yeah. But then, as your eyes track to the right side of the image, those jagged, broken lines, they begin to sweep together.
And it changes completely.
It does. They merge into this beautiful, flowing network of interconnected nodes. It looks organic, like the veins in a leaf or, iron filings aligning perfectly in a magnetic field.
Wow. And that visual basically represents the core thesis of the manuscript, right?
Exactly. It represents the movement from our current state of systemic fragmentation to what he calls a field of coherence.
A field of coherence. I want to emphasize that because in this context, coherence isn't just like a synonym for people getting along or having a cohesive argument.
No, not at all.
Sure.
It is a strict biological and systemic term.
Right.
Coherence is defined here as the dynamic alignment of processes that enable a living system to sense its environment, respond to it, and, sustain its functional integrity over time.
I really want to dig into that definition because if we're going to build a coherent system, we first need to diagnose the pathology of our current one, you know?
Wait to figure out what's broken.
Yeah. And Dr. Saffoli argues that all these cascading crises we see today, they're all symptoms of a systemic loss of coherence.
Which he traces back to three massive abstractions that modernity basically forced onto the world.
Okay, let's unpack these abstractions because it's not like modernity intentionally set out to ruin everything.
Right, it didn't intentionally set out to break our ecosystems or our bodies, but it broke them through a series of foundational shifts in how we process information.
So what's the first one?
The first of these abstractions was replacing lived qualitative experience with just rigid quantification.
Okay, so the shift from like how things actually feel to what the spreadsheet says.
Exactly. We see this traced back to the scientific revolution, the Cartesian split, where we decided that things we can physically measure, like mass or velocity, are quote unquote real.
Right.
And things we actually experience, like meaning, connection, or suffering, are secondary or just entirely subjective.
Which, I mean, was a great tool for building bridges and airplanes.
Oh, absolutely. It was an incredibly powerful epistemological tool for physics and engineering. But when we applied that exact same logic to human societies, we severed our systems from the actual signals they need to regulate themselves.
That is a huge realization because for hundreds of thousands of years, emotional and sensory perception was exactly how organisms registered changes in their environment.
Yes. But modern technocracy reclassified those perceptions as like unreliable biases.
Yeah.
We elevated the external metric as the sole arbiter of truth.
So we gained immense technological leverage, but our systems basically lost the capacity to feel their own state.
Exactly. which perfectly tees up the second abstraction, which is separating human activity from our ecological embeddedness.
Right, the idea that we are somehow outside of nature.
Yeah. We started treating human civilization as something happening on the planet rather than as a part of the planet.
Like we're just visiting.
Right. And conceptually, we reframe nature merely as a resource input in a waste sink. Biologically speaking, treating a human system as external to an ecological system is just a delusion.
Complete delusion.
But because we codified this abstraction, actions that destroy the biosphere, the literal life support system we rely on, well, they aren't registered by our institutions as self-harm.
Because it's just an input, which leads directly into the third abstraction, right? The way we define value.
Yes. The third abstraction is that we equated true value entirely with price and market exchange.
And this might actually be the most destructive abstraction of the three, honestly.
I would agree. When value is mathematically restricted to price, any activity that is essential for maintaining life is rendered totally invisible to the system.
Like what? Give me some examples.
Caregiving, ecological stewardship, maintaining a home, raising a regulated child. These activities produce no market exchange. So the system literally assumes they have zero value.
But meanwhile, extractive activities that tear down life capacities but generate financial returns, those are elevated as highly valuable.
Exactly. So the economic domain is completely decoupled from the biological reality it actually needs to survive.
It's terrifying when you lay it out like that. And Dr. Sekely gives a name to the architecture that enforces these abstractions. He calls it the ruling group mind.
Yes, the ruling group mind.
And I want to be very clear for everyone listening right now, he is not talking about some smoky back room of billionaires pulling the strings in secret.
No, it's not a conspiracy. The ruling group mind is a distributed cognitive pattern.
Right.
It is a structural logic embedded in our institutions, our algorithms, our legal frameworks, and our daily incentives.
It's everywhere.
It is. It prioritizes control, optimization, and abstract growth while remaining functionally blind to the qualitative conditions of life.
And it rewards any behavior that aligns with his abstract logic.
Exactly, while ruthlessly marginalizing anything that falls outside of it.
Okay, let me test an analogy here to see if I'm getting this. So the ruling group mind is like an autopilot system on a commercial plane.
Okay, I like where this is going.
The engineers programmed it to strictly optimize for fuel efficiency. It is relentlessly pursuing that one abstract metric. But a massive mountain suddenly appears in the flight path.
Right. Reality gets in the way.
Exactly. The human pilot sees the mountain, feels the terror, and tries to pull up. But the autopilot overrides the manual controls because pulling up would require a massive fuel burn, which ruins the metric.
Oh, wow.
So the system flies the plane directly into the mountain. The autopilot technically succeeded at its KPI right up until the literal moment of impact.
That captures the structural blindness perfectly. The autopilot lacks coherence because the mountain literally doesn't exist in its fuel efficiency spreadsheet.
It's blind to the reality.
And the tragic irony is that the individuals operating inside this ruling group mind, they often know the system is broken.
Yeah, the pilot knows the mountain is there.
Exactly. But they are constrained by the very incentive structures that define their professional survival.
I imagine anyone listening to this can relate. I mean, think about your own workplace. You've likely been forced to hit a specific metric, maybe maximizing call volume at a help desk or cutting costs on a manufacturing line.
Even when you intuitively knew it was burning out your team or producing a worse product.
Exactly. You were sensing reality. But the ruling group mind of your organization suppressed your feedback because it only cared about the dashboard.
And when a system loses the ability to recognize that its metrics are misaligned with reality, we see an erosion of regulatory capacity.
And this loss of coherence is playing out in our macroeconomy, our climate.
But crucially, it is playing out at the microscopic level inside our own bodies.
Which is the perfect pivot. If the massive systems of our society are failing because they run on abstract metrics and ignore reality, where do we find a system that actually gets this right?
We have to look inward.
Right. Dr. Sekely argues we have to look to the biological blueprint of a living organism.
To understand what intact coherence actually looks like, we have to contrast the old mechanistic view of biology with the new systems biology paradigm.
Okay, break that down for us. What was the old view?
Well, for a long time, Western medicine treated the body like a complex clockwork machine.
Yeah.
You have discrete, breakable parts. Disease is just a localized malfunction. and you intervene to fix that specific defect.
And to be fair, I mean, that mechanistic model is incredible if you get hit by a car and shatter your femur, right?
Right, absolutely.
You want a mechanic to go in with titanium plates and bolt the structure back together.
It is miraculous for acute trauma and acute infection. I don't want to dismiss that at all. But it is fundamentally insufficient for the landscape of complex chronic conditions that are overwhelming modern populations right now.
Because chronic conditions aren't just broken bones.
Right. Systems biology recognizes that an organism isn't just a collection of isolated parts. It is a nested network of interacting processes.
Interacting processes, okay.
Coherence at the cellular level is the continuous, coordinated flow of information, energy, and matter. Organs don't act alone. They're integrated into this vast communication network.
So health isn't just the absence of a broken part.
Exactly. Health is the capacity of the entire system to maintain that flow and restore it when disrupted.
This drastically changes how we understand chronic disease. If we aren't looking at broken parts, what exactly is happening when someone develops chronic inflammation or an autoimmune issue?
It all comes down to how living systems process threats.
Okay.
When a cell encounters a stressor, say a virus, a heavy metal toxin, or even severe psychological trauma, it initiates a highly conserved evolutionary response. It shifts into a defensive mode.
Like batting down the hatches.
Exactly. The mitochondria actually stop producing ATP for cellular energy and switch to a signaling role, sending out these alarm molecules.
Wait, really? The energy centers just stop making energy?
Yes. The cell alters its membrane, changes its communication pathways, and redirects all metabolic resources strictly toward immediate survival and walling off the threat.
It essentially drops all its long-term maintenance projects and goes straight to battle stations.
Exactly. And in the short term, this is brilliant, highly adaptive response. It stops the spread of damage.
All right.
But what happens if the threat never leaves? Or, even more profoundly, what happens if the environment is so chronically stressful that the system perceives the threat is always present?
The alarm never turns off.
Right. The system remains locked in a defensive state. The cells that stop talking to each other to quarantine an infection literally lose the ability to communicate normally.
Oh, wow.
The organism gets trapped in a metabolic mode that prioritizes isolation and defense over integration and flow. Chronic disease emerges when the system loses its regulatory capacity to return to baseline coherence.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm fully grasping the gravity of this because it kind of flips everything I thought I knew about medicine.
It's a big shift.
So, chronic inflammation isn't the body failing to do its job. It's the body doing its job too well. It's getting trapped in an evolutionary alarm loop because the environment never provides the biological all-clear signal.
You've hit the exact mechanism. The pathology is not just the presence of a foreign invader. It is a persistent pattern of misaligned signaling.
The system literally forgets how to turn the defense response off.
Which is why Dr. Saley emphasizes a profound shift in the objective of medical care. We have to move toward cellugenesis.
Cellugenesis.
Yeah.
The generation of health.
Yes. Healing is not just deploying a pharmaceutical weapon to violently suppress a symptom. Healing is fundamentally about restoring the environmental conditions of safety so that the cellular network can voluntarily drop its defenses and resume normal, coherent communication.
This completely exposes why so many modern interventions for chronic illness feel like a treadmill.
It really does.
If a patient comes in with metabolic syndrome and systemic inflammation, the mechanistic approach is to artificially hammer down their blood glucose with a pill, right? And prescribe an immunosuppressant.
Yes.
But if we haven't touched the systemic environment, if they're still working three jobs, breathing polluted air, suffering from chronic sleep deprivation, and dealing with intense social isolation, their cellular network is still receiving constant signals of threat.
Right. The pill might successfully alter the abstract metric on the lab report, much like the airplane autopilot hitting its fuel efficiency target we talked about earlier.
Oh, yeah.
But the underlying biological reality remains entirely incoherent. The cells are still screaming that they are under attack.
It's treating the dashboard instead of the engine.
Exactly.
But this biological reality raises a massive psychological question for me.
Okay, what is it?
If the cells of our body require signals of safety to drop their defenses, how does a human being actually learn to interpret what safety feels like in the real world? We aren't born knowing how to accurately gauge whether an environment is a threat or not, are we?
No, not at all. We are incredibly altricial, meaning we were born highly undeveloped. Our nervous systems do not arrive with pre-programmed regulatory capacities. The ability to modulate our heart rate, to evaluate facial expressions properly, and to engage in complex social problem solving, all of that requires a very specific developmental ground.
Let's explore the mechanics of that developmental ground. How does the hardware actually get wired?
It relies entirely on the primary caregivers and the early social environment. A developing infant relies on the nervous system of an adult to regulate its own.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Through warm, responsive caregiving, consistent emotional attunement, and physical safety, the neural pathways associated with adaptive regulation are biologically reinforced.
So they basically borrow our calm.
Exactly. The vagus nerve, which acts as the brake on our fight or flight system, gains tone. The prefrontal cortex, which handles executive function and social nuance, integrates effectively with the amygdala, the brain's threat detector.
So the child learns at a cellular level how to recover from stress. But what happens to the architecture of the brain when that developmental ground is characterized by chaos, neglect, or chronic trauma?
Well, the developing nervous system is highly plastic,
yeah,
right? And its primary mandate is survival.
Right.
If the environment is dangerous, the brain fundamentally alters its developmental trajectory. It downregulates glucocorticoid receptors, meaning it loses the ability to shut off the flow of the stress hormone cortisol.
Oh, so the stress just stays elevated.
Yeah. Neural systems dedicated to threat detection become hypervigilant and dominant. The systems meant for reflective processing, empathy, and social engagement become structurally underdeveloped.
Because if you live in a war zone, whether a literal one or an abusive household, pausing to thoughtfully consider the nuance of a situation will get you killed. You need hair trigger reactions.
Exactly. The brain's adaptation is biologically correct for the traumatic environment, but it permanently biases the nervous system toward threat detection.
Even decades later,
in a completely safe environment, that person's amygdala might interpret a neutral facial expression or a slightly delayed email as a life or death threat, triggering an immediate defensive cascade.
This scales up in a terrifying way, because societies are just macro structures built out of millions of these individual nervous systems.
It really does scale up.
And Dr. Sakely connects this directly to how we organize power, right? Contrasting the domination model with the partnership model.
Yes. If you look at human history, relational systems tend to organize along a spectrum between those two poles.
Okay, let's start with the domination model.
The domination model is strictly top-down. Power relies on coercion, rigid hierarchy, and the active suppression of feedback from the bottom. It prioritizes forced, unified action over complex, adaptive integration.
Whereas the partnership model distributes influence.
Exactly.
It relies on mutual coordination, open feedback loops, and adapting strategies based on signals coming from the edges of the network. It's highly resilient, but it requires a lot of trust.
And here is the systemic lock-in Dr. Sakely identifies. A society filled with individuals who suffered a disrupted developmental ground, people whose nervous systems are chronically dysregulated and biased toward threat, well, they will naturally gravitate toward domination systems.
I see exactly how that works. I mean, if my internal biology is chaotic and I am constantly flooded with threat signals, the ambiguity, patience, and nuance required for a partnership model feel completely overwhelming.
Yes, it feels dangerous.
I don't want complex dialogue. I want a strong man. I want rigid, simplistic roles that force predictability onto a terrifying world.
A domination system offers the illusion of safety through authoritarian control. But because it suppresses real feedback, it destroys systemic coherence.
Right.
And tragically, a domination system recreates the exact chaotic, stressful developmental ground that produces dysregulated children, perpetuating the cycle across generations.
I want to use a network topology analogy here to cement this. Trying to build a healthy, partnership-based democracy with a population suffering from mass nervous system dysregulation. It's like trying to build a dynamic, high-speed, fiber-optic network using damaged, frayed copper cables.
That is a phenomenal way to conceptualize it.
It literally does not matter how brilliant your societal software or your democratic constitution is. The physical hardware, our collective neurobiology, dictates the bandwidth of the society.
Yes.
If the cables are frayed, they can't carry the complex signals of partnership. The network will default to a rigid, centralized control hub just to prevent a total crash.
The macroscopic structure of our institutions fundamentally reflects the microscopic capacities of the participants. It has to.
Think about the organizations you interact with daily. Do they operate on a domination model where feedback is punished and compliance is demanded? Or a partnership model that adapts based on the lived experience of the team?
Because the environment you spend 8 hours a day in is actively wiring your nervous system toward either threat or integration.
And this naturally leads to a critical structural question. If domination systems and technocratic institutions survive by suppressing feedback from the bottom up, what is the specific nature of the data they are throwing away?
That's the million-dollar question.
In our modern institutions, it seems like the first thing to be completely discarded is emotional sentience.
Always.
We've been trained since the Industrial Revolution to view emotions as just noise, they're messy, subjective, and they bias the pure, hard data. We're told to leave our emotions at the door.
That is the defining assumption of the ruling group mind. And biologically, it is completely backwards.
How so?
Emotion is not the opposite of rational information processing. Emotion is an incredibly advanced, computationally heavy form of data processing.
I'm struggling a bit to see how a feeling of sadness or a gut instinct of anxiety equates to computational processing. Walk me through the neuroscience of how an emotion is actually generated.
So the brain is essentially a prediction engine. Through a process called interoception, regions like the insular cortex are constantly monitoring massive streams of input instantaneously.
Okay.
Your brain is reading your heart rate, your blood glucose levels, the micro-expressions on the faces around you, the tone of voice in the room, and is comparing all of that against decades of stored memories and contextual cues.
That's a lot of data.
It synthesizes millions of data points in milliseconds and hands your conscious mind an executive summary. That executive summary is what you experience as an emotion.
Oh, wow. So when I walk into a boardroom and immediately feel a knot of dread in my stomach, a visceral feeling that something is deeply wrong here, before anyone even speaks, that isn't me being irrational.
Not at all.
That is my nervous system acting as a supercomputer, processing atmospheric cues and relational dynamics far faster than my deliberative analytical prefrontal cortex ever could.
Precisely. Emotion guides attention. It highlights what is relevant in a sea of noise. Therefore, true objectivity should not mean stripping away the observer's feelings. If objectivity means accounting for all relevant information within a system, then actively ignoring the system's own experiential state, its emotional sentience, is actually a severe reduction of objectivity. It creates a massive blind spot.
This introduces what Dr. Saley refers to as opacity in our institutions.
Yes, opacity.
When an institution formally dismisses emotional signals because they can't be quantified on a ledger, those emotions don't cease to exist, right? They just become invisible to the decision makers.
And when leaders are flying blind to the experiential reality of their people, the system degrades rapidly. When an institution ignores pervasive burnout, profound alienation, or the collapse of meaning, it assumes it is operating optimally while its foundational components are literally breaking down.
I've seen this exact hallucination in the corporate world.
I think we all have.
A hospital administration will run an efficiency audit. Management looks at the dashboard and announces, "Great news, patient throughput is up 8%. Our new triage protocol is a massive success." But meanwhile, the nurses are experiencing unprecedented moral injury. They are crying in their cars before shifts, suffering from insomnia, and quietly applying for jobs in different fields because they feel like an assembly line worker rather than a caregiver.
It's tragic.
The administration isn't being objective by staring at that 8% throughput metric. The institution has severed its own sensory organs. It thinks the biological organism of the hospital is thriving while the tissue is actively dying.
That hospital example is a perfect microcosm of the macroeconomy. And this persistent hallucination only survives because of how we currently define and evaluate success.
Because of the metrics we use?
Yes. If our current financial metrics are inherently blind to biological health, ecological stability, and emotional reality, we must fundamentally redefine what constitutes value.
We established earlier that the ruling group mind equates value purely with price. If it sells, it has value. If it doesn't, it is economically non-existent.
Exactly.
And Dr. Saheeli proposes a radical departure from this. He introduces a concept called the life ground of value. Let's dig into that.
The life ground of value is a unifying principle. It posits that the true value of any process, structure, product, or intervention is determined solely by the extent to which it enables or disables the capacities of living systems to sustain, develop, and express themselves.
So life capacity becomes the ultimate irreducible metric. Does this action create more capacity for life to flourish, or does it diminish it?
Exactly. And Dr. Saley is very careful to frame this not as a utopian moral plea, but as a hard empirical necessity.
Meaning we have to do this to survive.
Yes. Think back to the system's biology. A biological organism that fails to measure and support the actual health of its cellular network will die.
Right.
A civilization that operates an economy that mathematically requires the destruction of the biosphere it sits inside is functionally incoherent. It is guaranteeing its own collapse.
I understand the theory, but pragmatically, this seems impossibly difficult to operationalize.
It's definitely a challenge.
I mean, financial price is so sticky because of its utility. It allows me to seamlessly compare the value of an apple to a laptop to an hour of legal consulting. How on earth do we build a global system that puts a tangible number on life capacity without grinding all trade to a halt?
It is the defining challenge of the transition. But Dr. Saley does not argue that we must abolish money, markets, or quantitative metrics. They are highly effective coordinating tools.
Okay, so we keep the tools.
The shift is not about eliminating the tool. It is about subordinating it. Price and profit must be treated strictly as proxies for value, not the value itself.
Right.
And the unbreakable rule of a coherent system is this. Whenever the proxy contradicts the health of the living system, the proxy must be systematically overridden.
So if the financial proxy, the quarterly profit margin, dictates that a corporation should clear-cut an ancient, old-growth forest, but the life-ground metric indicates that this specific forest regulates the regional watershed, sequesters carbon, and prevents local towns from catastrophic flooding.
Then the system must possess the regulatory mechanism to override the financial proxy.
The money must bow to the life capacity.
Yes. We don't abandon data. We evolve to pluralistic indicators. We must structurally integrate measures of ecological integrity, soil health, social cohesion, and biological well-being alongside economic metrics.
That makes total sense.
We must adopt a systemic view where a policy that increases gross domestic product but actively degrades the mental health of the population is universally recognized not as growth, but as a severe failure of coherence.
That reframing requires us to step directly into the belly of the beast. If we adopt the life ground of value, we have to completely redesign the most powerful engine of incoherence on the planet, our economy.
We must shift the foundational metaphor we use to understand the economy entirely.
Currently, the dominant metaphor is a mechanism for maximizing production and accumulating financial wealth.
Right. And Dr. Sasser Seely argues we must conceptually and structurally rebuild the economy as a living system of provisioning.
I love this transition. We look at the economy as a biological circulatory system.
Exactly. In a healthy biological circulatory system, the entire focus is on flow. Never accumulation.
Slow over accumulation.
The evolutionary purpose of circulation is to ensure that oxygen, energy, and nutrients are dynamically distributed to support the maintenance and resilience of the entire organism.
Right. It doesn't just pile up blood in one place.
Exactly. If a tissue is under stress and needs repair, flow is redirected there. Tissues that are stable maintain their baseline provisioning.
So money, in this metaphor, is not the goal of the organism. Money is simply the blood.
Yes.
It is the necessary medium used to coordinate the flow of provisioning caring resources to the societal tissues that need them.
And this biological metaphor gives us incredibly precise language to describe our current economic crises. In a human body, if blood pools and hyperaccumulates in one specific area while actively depriving surrounding tissues of oxygen, what is the medical diagnosis?
It's an ischemia. It's a blood clot. The tissue downstream of the clot starves and goes into necrosis.
Exactly. When we view the economy as a living system, hoarding unprecedented wealth while public infrastructure crumbles, rural hospitals close, and ecological stewardship is starved of funding, that is not winning the game of capitalism.
Oh.
It is the exact systemic pathology of a blood clot.
That is a staggering way to view inequality. A billionaire hoarding resources isn't just an abstract moral issue. From a systems biology perspective, they are functioning as a biological clot that is actively causing societal tissue death.
It is a profound, life-threatening misalignment of flow. And if the economy is a circulatory system, it requires a regulatory mechanism.
Like a heart.
Yes, but a human heart doesn't just pump blindly.
Yeah.
It is regulated by the vagus nerve in the autonomic nervous system, adjusting blood pressure and flow rate based on instantaneous feedback about the body's environment.
Right.
Our economy needs the equivalent of that nervous system to prevent these catastrophic clots.
Which is a perfect moment for anyone listening right now to reflect on their own economic reality. Where does your daily labor fit into this circulatory system? Are you engaged in work that genuinely provisions society growing food, educating minds, building shelter, healing bodies?
Or has the ruling group mind trapped you in a sector designed purely to accumulate abstract wealth while extracting vitality from the environment or exploiting your community?
It profoundly changes how you interpret your daily commute.
It really does. And to build that economic nervous system, we have to design institutions capable of sensing and responding to the flow.
This brings us to the concept of sentient architecture governance and what Dr. Saley calls the civil commons.
Yes, sentient governance.
Now, sentient governance sounds almost sci-fi. How do we build an institution that is sentient?
Well, a sentient systems architecture must be distributed, it must be highly adaptive, and it must utilize a functional rather than oppressive hierarchy.
I have to admit, I bristle a bit at the word hierarchy. In modern terms, hierarchy usually just means a domination system where the people at the top exploit the people at the bottom. How is a functional hierarchy different?
In biology, hierarchy is a structural necessity for managing complexity, not a mechanism of oppression.
Give me an example.
Your nervous system is hierarchical. The lower levels, like your spinal cord, handle immediate, localized, fast responses, like instinctively jerking your hand away from a hot stove.
Right.
You don't need to route that decision up to your prefrontal cortex to analyze it. You would burn your hand. But your higher brain centers integrate broader, slower patterns, like deciding not to touch the stove tomorrow. Governance must operate on this principle of subsidiarity.
So local qualitative knowledge, the lived, emotional, on-the-ground experience of a community, must have the authority to act locally, but it also must flow upward to inform broader strategy.
Yes, exactly.
Meanwhile, global frameworks and resources must flow downward, adapting to the local context rather than forcing a one-size-fits-all mandate.
It requires rich, bidirectional feedback loops. The autopilot must be constantly in dialogue with the pilot's senses. And the primary substrate that this sentient architecture is tasked with managing is the civil commons.
Now, when economists talk about the commons, they usually bring up the tragedy of the commons.
Oh, constantly.
They frame it as a shared resource that humans will inevitably abuse and deplete, which they use as an excuse to say everything must be enclosed and privatized.
Dr. Sahili aggressively pushes back against that framing. The civil commons is not just a shared pasture. It is the foundational, life-giving substrate of all collective human existence.
So, what does it encompass?
It encompasses our natural infrastructure, the water table, the atmosphere, the soil, but it also includes our social infrastructure, public health systems, knowledge networks, open-source technology, cultural heritage, and our baseline of social trust.
It's everything we share.
It is the literal ground upon which any private economic activity is even possible.
I'm trying to picture how we practically govern something that complex. If we rely entirely on local communities, we might get fragmented rules where one town pollutes the river that the next town relies on.
True.
But if we hand it over to a centralized federal bureaucracy, it becomes slow, blind to local needs, and easily captured by corporate lobbying. How does Sam Lee propose we thread this needle?
The mechanism is integrated stewardship.
Integrated stewardship.
The commons cannot be carved up and privatized into isolated, profit-seeking silos because that shatters the coherence of the whole. But it also cannot be managed by a distant, monolithic state.
So what's the alternative?
It requires stewardship, which is the active, responsive maintenance of the conditions that sustain life. And these stewardship structures must be embedded locally but networked globally.
Let's ground this in a real municipal environment. Look at how a typical city operates today. You have a public transit authority, a municipal water board, a housing department, and public health services.
All working separately.
They usually operate in complete isolation, fighting each other for budget. Worse, the city might privatize the water supply to a corporation seeking quarterly growth.
Which is a disaster.
The corporation raises rates to boost stock price, low-income families lose access to clean water, sanitation plummets, and the public health system is suddenly overwhelmed with infectious disease.
In that scenario, the financial proxy of the water company's profit succeeded brilliantly, but the LifeGround metric collapsed entirely.
Right.
Integrated stewardship requires a city to manage transit, water, housing, and health, not as isolated line items, but as an interconnected ecosystem designed explicitly to maximize the life capacity of the urban population.
So if free transit allows marginalized citizens to access preventative health care, the transit department's financial loss is an incredible systemic gain for the public health sector.
Exactly. The ledger must reflect the whole organism.
But implementing that level of integrated stewardship requires more than just rewiring our bureaucratic flowcharts. You can design the perfect sentient architecture on paper, but systems are ultimately animated by human beings.
Always.
Which brings us to the cultural substrate: myth, archetype, and daily practice.
Humans are fundamentally narrative creatures. We do not operate purely on raw logic or structural diagrams. We require meaning.
And how does that tie in?
Dr. Soshali argues that myth, which he defines as the deep, integrative narratives that weave our past, present, and future together, and archetype, the recurring roles that embody those narratives, are the invisible software that runs the hardware of our institutions.
I have to push back here. We've spent this entire deep dive discussing hard systems biology, evolutionary neurodevelopment, and macroeconomic restructuring.
I know, it's a shift.
Suddenly pivoting to poetry, mythology, and archetypes feels incredibly soft. Does calling someone an archetypal steward rather than a regional manager actually change how they operate a municipal water supply?
It fundamentally changes how they interpret data and respond to feedback. A purely technical job title ignores the ethical, emotional, and relational dimensions of human action.
Okay.
The prevailing myth of our current era is competition and scarcity. The dominant archetype we are all trained to emulate is the rational maximizer or the extractor.
Right.
If a water manager internalizes that myth, they will look at a reservoir and manage it to maximize efficiency, throughput, and revenue.
But if the cultural software changes?
If the guiding cultural myth shifts to interdependence and sufficiency, and the dominant archetype becomes the steward, the operator's perception of reality shifts.
Because they're looking at it through a different lens.
A steward doesn't just measure the flow rate of the pipes. They feel a profound, integrated responsibility for the biological health of the children drinking that water. Embodying an archetype expands the operator's sentience. It allows them to integrate emotional data alongside quantitative data.
Okay, I see how the narrative software dictates how the human components behave within the system. But this coherence isn't just a grand, sweeping theory. Zaylee makes it very clear that this has to translate to the micro level of daily practice.
Systemic coherence is not something you passively achieve. It is something you actively enact every single day. It requires individual practices.
Where do we start?
It starts with regulating your own nervous system, managing your attention, processing your trauma, and stepping out of chronic threat states.
That's huge.
It moves outward into how you engage in active, empathetic listening with your family and neighbors. It culminates in participating in civic life. You have to embody the pulse of coherence in your immediate local environment before it can scale up to the societal level.
This leads us to the ultimate existential challenge of this entire manuscript. We have the biological blueprint. We know the macroeconomy needs to function as a circulatory system provisioning life capacity.
We have the tools.
We have the sentient architecture, the concept of the commons, and the daily practices of the steward. But how do we actually cross the threshold?
That is the hardest part.
The ruling group mind currently commands the military, the financial system, and the algorithms. If we try to transition, how do we prevent the old system from crushing the new one?
This transition is the most precarious phase of civilizational development. As we learn from the biological model, entrenched systems carry deep histories of trauma, constraint, and dysregulation.
Right.
You cannot simply command a traumatized organism to heal. And crucially, you cannot fight the ruling group mind head on using its own tools of domination and coercion.
Because if we orchestrate a violent, top-down revolution to force people into a partnership model, we're just deploying another domination system. We become the very pathology we are trying to cure.
Exactly. Dr. Saley advocates for a process of systemic disengagement.
Deliberately withdrawing energy.
Yes. You do not necessarily assault the old system directly. You systematically stop feeding it. You withdraw your material, cognitive, and emotional energy from incoherent extractive patterns.
Wow.
You refuse to let your attention be captured by algorithmic outrage. You move your financial resources, your labor, and your social investments toward patterns that support integration and life capacity.
But disengaging from the dominant system creates a terrifying vacuum of uncertainty. I mean, we rely on these broken systems for our basic survival right now.
It induces massive uncertainty, which is why individual nervous system regulation is the prerequisite for transition.
Oh, because if we're dysregulated.
Dysregulated people panic in the face of ambiguity and run back to the familiarity of the domination system. We have to cultivate the internal capacity to hold space for the friction of transition. To do this, we rely on a concept from complex systems theory creating new attractors.
Walk me through how an attractor functions in complex systems.
An attractor is a stable state or pattern that a dynamic system naturally tends to evolve toward over time. Right now, the abstract logic of the ruling group mind is a massive, deep attractor basin.
It pulls human behavior toward extraction and hoarding.
To heal, we cannot just critique the old attractor. We must actively build parallel, highly coherent structures, new ways of growing food, new models of local governance, new decentralized networks of mutual aid.
We build a working prototype of the future in the shadow of the dying present.
Exactly. We repattern the system iteratively. As these new partnership-based structures prove more resilient, more joyful, and more capable of sustaining life, they become a gravitational force.
They become a new attractor.
Energy, labor, and capital naturally begin to flow toward them, and the old incoherent structures gradually starve, atrophy, and dissolve.
This is the moment where this entire massive theory becomes intensely personal and actionable for you, the listener.
It really empowers the individual.
It is easy to look at the scale of global crises and feel completely paralyzed. You might think, I have no power to change the global financial architecture or rewrite international treaties.
But you do have power.
Dr. Salhili's framework grants you incredible localized agency. By doing the hard work of healing your own nervous system, by refusing to operate on the frequency of constant panic, and by demanding and building partnership-based feedback loops in your own home and workplace, you are literally building the new attractors.
You are the vanguard of systemic disengagement.
The ultimate horizon is the emergence of a field of coherence, a unified state where biological, relational, structural, and cultural processes all align, vibrating on the frequency of life capacity.
And this field cannot be engineered from a centralized control room.
It has to be organic.
It must emerge organically from the localized, integrated practices of millions of stewards everywhere, all at once.
What a profound journey we've taken today. Let's trace our steps back. We started by diagnosing the ruling group mind, the autopilot flying human civilization into the mountain because it only values abstract financial metrics while remaining totally blind to biological reality.
Right.
We looked inward to systems biology, discovering that chronic illness isn't a broken machine, but a cellular network trapped in a defensive loop because it never receives the signal of safety.
We examined how our early developmental ground wires our neurobiology, driving societies toward either authoritarian domination or resilient partnership.
We realize that emotions are not irrational noise, but highly advanced sensory data crucial for objective decision making.
We embrace the life ground of value, subordinating money to the actual flourishing of life.
We reimagine the entire economy as a living circulatory system where billionaire hoarding is diagnosed as a deadly biological clot.
We mapped out a sentient governance architecture rooted in local feedback to steward the civil commons.
And finally, we saw that by embracing the archetype of the steward and engaging in systemic disengagement, we can build the new attractors that will pull our civilization into a field of coherence.
It provides a comprehensive, empirically grounded lens for civilizational viability. It proves that we are not fighting a dozen disparate fires. We are engaged in one fundamental transition.
Yeah.
The journey from blind fragmentation to sentient alignment.
As we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to carry with you. We've talked extensively about the vertigo, the anxiety, and the burnout of living in this modern era. Think about the last time you felt deeply, overwhelmingly anxious about the state of the world.
We've all been there.
What if that feeling wasn't a personal failure? What if it wasn't a biological defect or a chemical imbalance that simply needs to be suppressed with a pharmaceutical so you can get back to being a quote-unquote productive worker?
That changes everything.
What if your anxiety, your burnout, and your grief are actually your body acting as a perfectly functioning, highly advanced biological sensor? What if your nervous system is accurately, objectively detecting the profound incoherence and extraction of the economic and social systems around you?
Wow.
You aren't broken. You are sensing the exact feedback the system desperately needs to heal. You are the pilot, wide awake, trying to pull the plane up.
A beautiful, necessary, and biologically accurate reframing.
Thank you for embarking on this incredible deep dive with us today. The next time you step outside and look at the world, try to hold Dr. Salhili's visual metaphor in your mind. Look past the fragmented, jagged, broken grid lines of the decaying system.
Look for the connections.
Train your eyes to look for the places where the nodes are connecting. Look for the flow of life capacity. Look for the coherence and carry that lens into everything you do. We'll see you next time.